may be worried about cops, which suited Kelly just fine. Behind him, he had not troubled to see, was a dark, scarcely lit corridor of blank brick walls, inhabited by nothing more than trash cans and stray cats, and open at the far end.
"Let's see, for girls, rest of the evening, shall we say, and something to help get the party started. 500 should do it.
My girls aren't cheap, but you will get your monies." "Both hands in the open," Kelly said, the Colt automatic leveled 12 inches from the man's chest. Lamarck's first response was a disbelieving bluster.
"My man, that is a very foolish—"
Kelly's voice was all business. "Arguing with a gun is even more foolish, my man. Turn, walk down the alley, and you might even make it back to the bar for a nightcap."
"You must need money real bad to try something this dumb," the pimp said, trying an implied threat.
"Your role worth dying for?" Kelly asked reasonably. Lamarck measured the odds and turned, moving into the shadows. "Stop," Kelly told him after 50 yards, still behind the blank wall of the bar, or perhaps another just like it. His left arm grabbed the man's neck and pushed him against the bricks. His eyes looked up and down the alley 3 times. His ears searched for sounds separate from traffic noise and distorted music. For the moment, it was a safe and quiet place.
"Hand me your gun. Real careful."
"I don't." The sound of a hammer being cocked sounded awfully loud, that close to his ear. "Do I look stupid?"
"Okay, okay," Lamarck said, his voice losing its smooth edge now. "Let's be real cool. It's only money."
"That's smart," Kelly said approvingly. A small automatic appeared. Kelly put his right index finger into the trigger guard. There was no sense in putting fingerprints on the weapon. He was taking enough chances, and as careful as he'd been to this point, the dangers of his action were suddenly very real and very large. The pistol fit nicely into his coat pocket.
"Let's see the roll next."
"Right here, man." Lamarck was starting to lose it. That was both good and bad, Kelly thought. Good because it was pleasing to see. Bad because a panicked man might do something foolish. Instead of relaxing, Kelly actually became more tense.
"Thank you, Mr. Lamarck," Kelly said politely, to calm the man.
Just then he wavered, and his head turned a few inches or so, as his consciousness asserted itself through the 6 drinks he'd had this evening.
"Wait a minute. You said you knew Pam."
"I did," Kelly said.
"But why?"
He turned farther to see a face that was bathed in darkness, only eyes showing with light glistening off their moisture, and the rest of the face a shadow white.
"You're one of the guys who ruined her life."
Outrage.
"Hey, man, she came to me."
"And you got her on pills so she could party real good, right?" the disembodied voice asked. Lamarck could hardly remember what the man looked like now.
"That was business, so you met her, so she was a good fuck, right?"
"She certainly was."
"I should have trained her better, and you could have had her again instead of—"
"Was, you say?" "She's dead," Kelly told him, reaching in his pocket. "Somebody killed her."
"So? I didn't do it."
It seemed to Lamarck that he was facing a final exam, a test he didn't understand, based on rules he didn't know.
"Yes, I know that," Kelly said,
screwing the silencer onto the pistol. Lamarck saw that somehow, his eyes making the adjustment to the darkness. His voice became a shrill rasp.
"Then what are you doing this for?"
the man said, too puzzled even to scream, too paralyzed by the incongruity of the past few minutes, by the passage of his life from the normality of his hangout bar to its end only 40 feet away in front of a windowless brick wall. And he had to have an answer. Somehow it was more important than the escape, whose attempt he knew to be futile. Kelly thought about that for a second or two. He could have said many things, but it was only fair, he decided, to tell the man the truth as the gun came up quickly and finally. Practice. Chapter 14. Lessons Learned. The early flight back from New Orleans to Washington National was too short for a movie, and Kelly had already eaten breakfast.
He settled on a glass of juice at his window seat, and was thankful that the flight was only about a third full, as, after every combat action of his life, he went over every detail. It was a habit that had begun in the SEALs. Following every training exercise, there had been an event called various things by his various commanders. Performance critique seemed most appropriate at the moment. His first mistake had been the product of something desired and something forgotten. In wanting to see Lamarck die in the darkness, he'd stood too close, simultaneously forgetting that head wounds often bleed explosively. He'd jumped out of the way of the spouting blood like a child avoiding a wasp in his backyard, but had still not escaped it entirely. The good news was that he'd made only that one mistake, and his selection of dark clothing had mitigated the danger there. Lamarck's wounds had been immediately and definitively fatal. The pimp had fallen to the ground as limp as a rag doll. The two screws that Kelly had drilled in the top of his pistol held a small cloth bag he'd sewn himself, and the bag had caught the two ejected cartridge cases, leaving the police who'd investigate the scene without that valuable bit of evidence. His stalk had been effectively carried out. Just one more anonymous face in a large and anonymous bar. His hastily selected site for the elimination had also worked well enough. He remembered walking down the alley and blending back into the sidewalk traffic, walking the distance to his car and driving back to the motel. There he'd changed clothes, bundling the blood-spattered slacks, shirt, and, just to be sure, the underwear as well, into a plastic cleaner bag, which he'd walked across the street and deposited in a supermarket dumpster. If the clothing was discovered, it might well be taken as something soiled by a sloppy meat cutter. He hadn't met with Lamarck in the open. The only lighted place in which they'd spoken was the bar's men's room, and there fortune and planning had smiled on him. The sidewalk they'd walked on was too dark and too anonymous. Perhaps a casual observer who might have known Lamarck could give an investigator a rough idea of Kelly's size, but little else. And that was a reasonable gamble to have taken, Kelly judged, looking down at the wooded hills of northern Alabama. It had been an apparent robbery, the pimp's $1,470 of flash money tucked away in his bag. Cash was cash, after all. And not to have taken it would have shown the police that there had been a real motive in the elimination, aside from something easily understandable and agreeably random. The physical side of the event, he could not think of it as a crime, was, he thought, as clean as he could have done it. Psychological? Kelly asked himself. More than anything else, Kelly had tested his nerve, the elimination of Pierre Lamarck having been a kind of field experiment. And in that he'd surprised himself. It had been some years since Kelly had entered combat, and he'd halfway expected a case of the shakes after the event. Such things had happened to him more than once before, but though his stride away from Lamarck's body had been slightly uneasy, he'd handled the escape with the sort of tense aplomb that had marked many of his operations in Vietnam. So much had come back to him. He could catalog the familiar sensations that had returned as though he'd been watching a training film of his own production. The increased sensory awareness, as though his skin had been sandblasted, exposing every nerve. Hearing, sight, smell, all amplified. I was so fucking alive at that moment, he thought. It was vaguely sad that such a thing had happened due to the ending of a human life, but Lamarck had long since forfeited his right to life. In any just universe, a person, Kelly simply could not think of him as a man, who exploited helpless girls simply did not deserve the privilege of breathing the same air used by other human beings. Perhaps he'd taken the wrong turn, been unloved by his mother or beaten by his father. Perhaps he'd been socially deprived, raised in poverty, or exposed to inadequate schooling. But those were matters for psychiatrists or social workers. Lamarck had acted normally enough to function as a person in his community, and the only question that mattered to Kelly was whether or not he had lived his life in accordance with his own free will. That had clearly been the case, and those who took improper actions, he had long since decided, ought to have considered the possible consequences of those actions. Every girl they exploited might have had a father or mother or sister or brother or lover to be outraged at her victimization. In knowing that and in taking the risk, Lamarck had knowingly gambled his life to some greater or lesser degree. And gambling means that sometimes you lose, Kelly told himself. If he hadn't weighed the hazards accurately enough, that was not Kelly's problem, was it? No, he told the ground, 37,000 feet below. And what did Kelly feel about it? He pondered that question for a while, leaning back and closing his eyes as though napping. A quiet voice, perhaps conscience, told him that he ought to feel something, and he searched for a genuine emotion. After several minutes of consideration, he could find none. There was no loss, no grief, no remorse. Lamarck had meant nothing to him, and probably would be no loss to anyone else. Perhaps his girls, Kelly had counted five of them in the bar, would be without a pimp, but then maybe one of them would seize the opportunity to correct her life. Unlikely, perhaps, but possible. It was realism that told Kelly he couldn't fix all the problems of the world. It was idealism that told him his inability to do so did not preclude him from addressing individual imperfections. But all that took him away from the initial question. What did he feel about the elimination of Pierre Lamarck? The only answer he could find was nothing. The professional elation of having done something difficult was different from satisfaction, from the nature of the task. In ending the life of Pierre Lamarck, he had removed something harmful from the surface of the planet. It had enriched him not at all. Taking the money had been a tactic, a camouflage measure, certainly not an objective. It had not avenged Pam's life. It had not changed very much. It had been like stepping on an offensive insect. You did it and moved on. He would not try to tell himself different, but neither would his conscience trouble him, and that was sufficient to the moment. His little experiment had been a success. After all the mental and physical preparation, he had proven himself worthy of the task before him. Kelly's mind focused behind closed eyes on the mission before him. Having killed many men better than Pierre Lamarck, he could now think with confidence about killing men worse than the New Orleans pimp. This time they visited him, Greer saw with satisfaction. On the whole, CIA's hospitality was better. James Greer had arranged parking in the VIP visitors area. The equivalent at the Pentagon was always haphazard and difficult to use, and a secure conference room. Kaz Podolsky thoughtfully selected a seat at the far end, close to the air-conditioning vent, where his smoking wouldn't bother anyone.
"Dutch, you were right about this kid," Greer said, handing out typed copies of the handwritten notes which had arrived 2 days earlier. "Somebody ought to have put a gun to his head and walked him into OCS. He would have been the kind of junior officer we used to be."
Podolsky chuckled at his end of the table.
"No wonder he got out," he said with light-hearted bitterness. "I'd be careful putting a gun to his head," Greer observed with a chuckle of his own. "I spent a whole night last week going through his package. This guy's a wild one in the field."
"Wild?" Maxwell asked, with a hint of disapproval in his voice.
"Spirited, you mean, James?"
Perhaps a compromise, Greer thought.
A self-starter. He had three commanders, and they backed him on every play he made except one.
Plastic Flower? The political action major he killed?
Correct. His lieutenant was furious about that, but if it's true about what he had to watch, the only thing you can fault was his judgment, rushing in the way he did.
I read through that, James. I doubt if I could have held back, Kaz said, looking up from his notes. Once a fighter pilot, always a fighter pilot.
Look at this, even his grammar is good.
Despite his accent, Podolsky had been assiduous in learning his adopted language.
Jesuit High School, Greer pointed out. I've gone over our in-house assessment of Kingpin.
Kelly's analysis tracks on every major point except where he calls a few spades.
Who did the CIA assessments? Maxwell asked.
Robert Ritter.
He's a European specialist they brought in. Good man, a little terse, knows how to work the field, though.
Operations guy? Maxwell asked.
Right, Greer nodded. Did some very nice work working Station Budapest.
And why, Podolsky asked, did they bring in a guy from that side of the house to look over the Kingpin operation?
I think you know the answer, Kaz, Maxwell pointed out.
If Boxwood Green goes, we need an operations guy from this house. We have to have it. I don't have the juice to do everything. Are we agreed on that?
Greer looked around the table, seeing the reluctant nods.
Podolsky looked back down at his documents before saying what they all thought.
Can we trust him?
He's not the one who burned Kingpin.
Kaz, we have Jim Angleton looking at that. It was his idea to bring Ritter on board.
I'm new here, people. Ritter knows the bureaucracy here better than I do. He's an operator. I'm just an analyst type. And his heart's in the right place. He damn near lost his job protecting a guy. He had an agent working inside GRU, and it was time to get him out. The decision weenies upstairs didn't like the timing with the arms talks going on, and they told him no. Ritter brought the guy out anyway. It turned out his man had something State needed, and that saved Ritter's career.
It hadn't done much for the martini mixer upstairs, Greer didn't add, but that was a person CIA was doing rather well without.
Swashbuckler? Maxwell asked.
He was loyal to his agent. Sometimes people here forget about that, Greer said.
Admiral Podolsky looked up the table.
Sounds like our kind of guy.
Brief him in, Maxwell ordered.
But you tell him that if I ever find out some civilian in the building fucked up our chance to get these men out, I will personally drive down to Pax River, personally check out an A4, and personally napalm his house.
You should let me do that, Dutch, Kaz added with a smile. I've always had a better hand for dropping things. Besides, I have 600 hours in the scooter.
Greer wondered how much of that was humor.
What about Kelly? Maxwell asked.
His CIA identity is Clark now. If we want him in, we can utilize him better as a civilian. He'd never get over being a chief, but a civilian doesn't have to worry about rank.
Make it so, Maxwell said.
It was convenient, he thought, to have a naval officer seconded to CIA, wearing civilian clothes but still subject to military discipline.
Aye, aye, sir.
If we get to training, where will it be done?
Quantico Marine Base, Maxwell replied. General Young is a pal from the old days. Aviator. He understands.
Marty and I went through test pilot school together, Podolsky explained.
From what Kelly says, we don't need that many troops. I always figured Kingpin was overmanned. You know, if we bring this off, we have to get Kelly his medal.
One thing at a time, Kaz.
Maxwell set that aside, looking back to Greer as he stood.
You will let us know if Angleton finds out anything?
Depend on it, Greer promised.
If there's a bad guy inside, we'll get his ass. I've fished with the guy. He can pull a brook trout out of thin air.
After they left, he set an afternoon meeting with Robert Ritter. It meant putting Kelly off, but Ritter was more important now, and while there was a rush on the mission, it wasn't all that great a rush. Airports were useful places, with their bustling anonymity and telephones. Kelly placed his call as he waited for his baggage to appear. He hoped, in the proper place.
Greer, the voice said.
Clark, Kelly replied, smiling at himself. It seemed so James Bond to have a cover name.
I'm at the airport, sir. Do you still want me in this afternoon?
No, I'm tied up.
Greer flipped through his daybook.
Tuesday, 3:30. You can drive in. Give me your car type and license number.
Kelly did that, surprised that he'd been bumped.
You get my note, sir?
Yes, and you did a fine job, Mr. Clark. We'll be going over them Tuesday. We are very pleased with your work.
Thank you, sir, Kelly said into the phone. See you Tuesday. The line clicked off. And thanks for that, too, Kelly said after he hung up. 20 minutes later, he had his bags and was walking off to his car. About an hour after that, he was in his Baltimore apartment. It was lunchtime, and he fixed a couple of sandwiches, chasing both down with Coca-Cola. He hadn't shaved today, and his heavy beard made a shadow on his face, he saw in the mirror. He'd leave it. Kelly headed into the bedroom for a lengthy nap. The civilian contractors didn't really understand what they were up to, but they were being paid. That was all they really required, since they had families to feed and house payments to make. The buildings they had just erected were well to the right of Spartan. Bare concrete block, nothing in the way of utilities, built to odd proportions, not like American construction at all except for the building materials. It was as though their size and shape had been taken from some foreign construction manual. All the dimensions were metric, one worker noted, though the actual plans were noted in odd numbers of inches and feet, as American building plans had to be. The job itself had been simple enough, the site already cleared when they'd first arrived. A number of the construction workers were former servicemen, most ex-Army, but a few Marines as well. And they were at turns pleased and uncomfortable to be at this sprawling Marine base in the wooded hills of northern Virginia. On the drive into the construction site, they could see the morning formations of officer candidates jogging along the roads. All those bright young kids with shaved heads, one former corporal of the 1st Marines had thought this very morning. How many would get their commissions? How many would deploy there? How many would come home early, shipped in steel boxes? It was nothing he could foresee or control, of course. He'd served his time in hell and returned unscratched, which was still remarkable to the former grunt who'd heard all too often the supersonic crack of rifle bullets. To have survived at all was amazing enough. The roofs were finished. Soon it would be time to leave the site for good, after a mere 3 weeks of well-paid work. 7-day weeks. Plenty of overtime on every working day he'd been here. Somebody had wanted this place built in a hurry. Some very odd things about it, too. The parking lot, for one. 100-slot blacktopped lot. Someone was even painting the lines. For buildings with no utilities. But strangest of all was the current job that he'd drawn because the site foreman liked him. Playground equipment. A large swing set. A huge jungle gym. A sandbox complete with half a dump truck's load of sand. All the things that his 2-year-old son would someday cavort on when he was old enough for kindergarten in the Fairfax County schools. But it was structural work, and it required assembly. And the former Marine and two others fumbled through the plans like fathers in a backyard, figuring which bolts went where. Theirs was not to reason why. Not as union construction workers on a government contract. Besides, he thought, there was no understanding the green machine. The Corps operated according to a plan that no man really figured out. And if they wanted to pay him overtime for this, then that was another monthly house payment earned for every 3 days he came here. Jobs like this might be crazy, but he sure liked the money. About the only thing he didn't like was the length of the commute. Maybe they'd have to do something equally crazy at Fort Belvoir, he hoped, finishing the last item on the jungle gym. He could drive from his house to that place in 20 minutes or so. But the Army was a little more rational than the Corps. It had to be. So, what's new? Peter Henderson asked. They were dining just off the hill. Two acquaintances from New England, one a Harvard graduate, the other from Brown, one a junior aide to a senator, the other a junior member of the White House staff. It never changes, Peter, Wally Hicks said resignedly. The peace talks are going nowhere. We keep killing their people, they keep killing ours. I don't think there's ever going to be peace in our time, you know. It has to, Wally, Henderson said, reaching for his second beer. If it doesn't, Hicks started to say gloomily. Both had been seniors at the Andover Academy in October 1962, close friends and roommates who had shared class notes and girlfriends. Their real political majority had come one Tuesday night, however, when they'd watched their country's president give a tense national address on the black-and-white television in the dormitory lounge. There were missiles in Cuba, they'd learned, something that had been hinted at in the papers for several days. But these were children of the TV generation, and contemporary reality came in horizontal lines on a glass tube. For both of them, it had been a stunning, if somewhat belated, entree into the real world for which their expensive boarding school ought to have prepared them more speedily. But theirs was the fat and lazy time for American youth, all the more so that their wealthy families had further insulated them from reality with the privilege that money could buy without imparting the wisdom required for its proper use. The sudden and shocking thought had arrived in both minds at the same instant. It could all be over. Nervous chatter in the room told them more. They were surrounded by targets. Boston to the southeast, Westover Air Force Base to the southwest, two other SAC bases, Pease and Loring, within a 100-mile radius, Portsmouth Naval Base, which housed nuclear submarines. If the missiles flew, they would not survive. Either the blast or the fallout would get them. And neither of them had even gotten laid yet. Other boys in the dorm had made their claims. Some of them, perhaps, might even have been true. But Peter and Wally didn't lie to each other. And neither had scored, despite repeated and earnest efforts. How was it possible that the world didn't take their personal needs into account? Weren't they the elite? Didn't their lives matter? It was a sleepless night that Tuesday in October. Henderson and Hicks sitting up, whispering their conversation, trying to come to terms with a world that had transformed itself from comfort to danger without the proper warning. Clearly, they had to find a way to change things. After graduation, though each went a separate way, Brown and Harvard were separated by only a brief drive, and both their friendship and their mission in life continued and grew. Both majored in political science because that was the proper major for entering into the process which really mattered in the world. Both got master's degrees, and, most important of all, both were noticed by people who mattered. Their parents helped there, and in finding a form of government service that did not expose them to uniformed servitude. The time of their vulnerability to the draft was early enough that a quiet telephone call to the right bureaucrat was sufficient. And so, now, both young men had achieved their own entry-level positions in sensitive posts, both as aides to important men. Their heady expectations of landing policy-making roles, while still short of 30, had run hard into the blank wall of reality. But, in fact, they were closer to it than they fully appreciated. In screening information for their bosses, and deciding what appeared on the master's desk in what order, they had a real effect on the decision process. And they also had access to data that was wide, diverse, and sensitive. As a result, in many ways, both knew more than their bosses did. And that, Hicks and Henderson thought, was fitting, because they often understood the important things better than their bosses did. It was also clear. War was a bad thing and had to be avoided entirely, or, when that wasn't possible, ended as rapidly as one could bring it about. Because war ended lives, and that was a very bad thing. And with war out of the way, people could learn to solve their disagreements peacefully. It was so obvious, both stood in wonder, that so many people failed to grasp the simple clarity of the truth that both men had discovered in high school. There was only one difference between the two, really. As a White House staffer, Hicks worked inside the system. But he shared everything with his classmate, which was okay because both had special access security clearances. And, besides, he needed the feedback of a trained mind he both understood and trusted. Hicks didn't know that Henderson had taken one step beyond him. If he couldn't change government policy from the inside, Henderson had decided during the days of rage following the Cambodia incursion, he had to get help from the outside, some outside agency that could assist him in blocking government actions that endangered the world. There were others around the world who shared his aversion to war, people who saw that you couldn't force people to accept a form of government they really didn't want. The first contact had come at Harvard, a friend in the peace movement. Now he communicated with someone else. He ought to have shared this fact with his friend, Henderson told himself, but the timing just wasn't right. Wally might not understand yet. It has to, and it will, Henderson said, waving to the waitress for another round. The war will end. We will get out. Vietnam will have the government it wants. We will have lost a war, and that will be a good thing for our country. We'll learn from that. We'll learn the limits of our power. We'll learn to live and let live, and then we can give peace a chance. Kelly arose after 5. The events of the previous day had left him more fatigued than he had appreciated, and besides, traveling had always tired him out. But he was not tired now. A total of 11 hours' sleep in the last 24 had left him fully rested and alert. Looking in the mirror, he saw the heavy beard from almost 2 days' worth of growth. Good. Then he selected his clothing. Dark, baggy, and old. He'd taken the whole bundle down to the laundry room and washed everything with hot water and extra bleach to abuse the fabric and mute the colors, making already shabby clothing look all the more unsightly. Old white gym socks and sneakers completed the picture, though both were more serviceable than their appearance suggested. The shirt was too large for him, and long, which suited his purposes. A wig completed the picture he wanted, made of coarse black Asian hair, none too long. He held it under a hot water faucet and soaked it, then brushed it out in a deliberately sloppy way. He'd have to find a way to make it smell, too, Kelly thought. Nature again provided some additional cover. Evening storms were rolling in, bringing with them leaf-swirling wind and rain that covered him on the way to his Volkswagen. 10 minutes later, he parked near a neighborhood liquor store, where he purchased a bottle of cheap yellow wine and a paper bag to semi-conceal it. He took off the twist cap and poured about half of it into a gutter. Then it was time to go. It all looked different now, Kelly thought. It was no longer an area he could pass through, seeing the dangers or not. Now it was a place of sought danger. He drove past the spot where he'd led Billy and his roadrunner, turning to see if the tire marks were still there. They weren't. He shook his head. That was in the past, and the future occupied his thoughts. In Vietnam, there always seemed to be the tree line, a spot where you passed from the openness of a field or farmed area into the jungle. And in your mind, that was the place where safety ended and danger began, because Charlie lived in the woods. It was just a thing of the mind, a boundary imaginary rather than real, but in looking around this area, he saw the same thing. Only this time he wasn't walking in with 5 or 10 comrades in striped jungle fatigues. He was driving through the barrier in a rust-speckled car. He accelerated, and, just like that, Kelly was in the jungle, and again at war. He found a parking place among autos as decrepit as his own, and quickly got out, as he once would have run away from a helicopter LZ the enemy might see and approach, and headed into an alley dotted with trash and several discarded appliances. His senses were alert now. Kelly was already sweating, and that was good. He wanted to sweat and smell. He took a mouthful of the cheap wine and sloshed it around his mouth before letting it dribble out onto his face, neck, and clothing. Bending down briefly, he got a handful of dirt, which he rubbed onto his hands and forearms, and a little onto his face. An afterthought added some to the hair of his wig, and by the time Kelly had passed through the city block length of the alley, he was just one more wino, a street bum like those who dotted the area even more than the drug pushers. Kelly adjusted his gait, slowing down and becoming deliberately sloppy in his movements while his eyes searched for a good perch. It wasn't all that difficult.
Several of the houses in the area were vacant, and it was just a matter of finding one with a good view. That required half an hour. He settled for a corner house with upstairs bay windows. Kelly entered it from the back door. He nearly jumped out of his skin when he saw two rats in the wreckage of what a few years before had been a kitchen. Fucking rats. It was foolish to fear them, but he loathed their small black eyes and leprous hair and naked tails. Shit, he whispered to himself. Why hadn't he thought about that? Everybody got a creeping chill from something. Spiders, snakes, or tall buildings. For Kelly, it was rats. He walked towards the doorway, careful to keep his distance. The rats merely looked at him, edging away but less afraid of him than he was of them. Fuck, they heard him whisper, leaving them to their meal. What followed was anger. Kelly made his way up the unbannistered stairs and found the corner bedroom with the bay windows, furious with himself for allowing such a dumb and cowardly distraction. Didn't he have a perfectly good weapon for dealing with rats? What were they going to do? Assemble into a battalion for a rat-wave attack? That thought finally caused an embarrassed smile in the darkness of the room. Kelly crouched at the windows, evaluating his field of view and his own visibility. The windows were dirty and cracked. Some glass panels were missing entirely, but each window had a comfortable sill on which he could sit, and the house's location at the corner of two streets gave him a long view along each of the four main points of the compass, since this part of the city streets was laid out along precisely surveyed north-south, east-west lines. There wasn't enough illumination on the streets for those below him to see into the house. With his dark, shabby clothing, in this unfit and derelict house, Kelly was invisible. He took out a small pair of binoculars and began his reconnaissance. His first task was to learn the environment. The rain showers passed, leaving moisture in the air that made for little globes of light punctuated by the flying insects attracted to their eventual doom by streetlights. The air was still warm, perhaps mid-80s, falling slowly, and Kelly was perspiring a little. His first analytical thought was that he should have brought water to drink. Well, he could correct that in the future, and he didn't really need a drink for some hours. He had thought to bring chewing gum, and that made things easier. The sounds of the streets were curious. In the jungle, he'd heard the tittering of insects, the calls of birds, and the flapping of bats. Here it was automotive sounds, near or distant, the occasional squeal of brakes, conversations loud or muted, barking dogs, and rattling trash cans, all of which he analyzed while watching through his binoculars and considering his actions for the evening. Friday night, the start of the weekend, and people were making their purchases. It seemed this was a busy night for the gentry business. He identified one probable dealer a block and a half away. Early 20s. 20 minutes of observation gave him a good physical picture of both the dealer and his assistant, Lieutenant. Both moved with the ease that came both with experience and security in their place, and Kelly wondered if they had fought either to take this place or to defend it. Perhaps both. They had a thriving trade, perhaps regular customers, he thought, watching both men approach an imported car, joshing with the driver and passenger before the exchange was made, shaking hands and waving afterwards. The two were roughly the same height and build, and he assigned them the names Archie and Jughead. Jesus, what an innocent I was, Kelly told himself, looking down another street. He remembered that one asshole they'd caught smoking grass in Third Sog, right before going out on a job. It had been Kelly's team and Kelly's man, and though he was an FNK right from SEAL school, that was no excuse at all. Confronting the man, he'd explained reasonably but positively that going into the field in anything less than 100% alert state could mean death for the entire team. "Hey, man, it's cool. I know what I'm doing," had not been a particularly intelligent response. And 30 seconds later, another team member had found it necessary to pull Kelly off the instantly ex-member of the team, who was gone the next day, never to return. And that had been the only instance of drug use in the entire unit as far as Kelly knew.
Sure, off duty, they'd had their beer bashes. And when Kelly and two others had flown to Taiwan for R&R, their collective vacation had not been terribly unlike a mobile earthquake of drunken excesses. Kelly truly believed that was different, blind to the explicit double standard. But they didn't drink beer before heading into the boonies either. It was a matter of common sense. It had also been one of unit morale. Kelly knew of no really elite unit that had developed a drug problem. The problem, a very serious one indeed, he'd heard, was mainly in the REMFs and the draftee units composed of young men whose presence in Vietnam was even less willing than was his own, and whose officers hadn't been able to overcome the problem either because of their own failings or their not dissimilar feelings. Whatever the cause, the fact that Kelly had hardly considered the problem of drug use was both logical and absurd. He set all of that aside. However late he had learned about it, it was here before his eyes. Down another street was a solo dealer who didn't want, need, or have a lieutenant. He wore a striped shirt and had his own clientele. Kelly thought of him as Charlie Brown. Over the next 5 hours, he identified and classified three other operations within his field of view. Then the selection process began. Archie and Jughead seemed to be doing the most business, but they were in line of sight to two others. Charlie Brown seemed to have his block entirely to himself, but there was a bus stop only a few yards away. Dagwood was right across the street from the Wizard. Both had lieutenants, and that took care of that. Big Bob was even larger than Kelly, and his lieutenant was larger still. That was a challenge. Kelly wasn't really looking for challenges. Yet. I need to get a good map of the area and memorize it. Divide it into discrete areas, Kelly thought. I need to plot bus lines, police stations, learn police shift times, patrol patterns. I have to learn this area. A 10-block radius ought to be enough. I can't ever park the car in the same place twice. No one parking place even visible from another. You can hunt a specific area only once. That means you have to be careful whom you select. No movement on the street except in darkness. Get a backup weapon. Not a gun. A knife, a good one. A couple lengths of rope or wire. Gloves, rubber ones like women use to wash dishes. Another thing to wear, like a bush jacket. Something with pockets. No, something with pockets on the inside. A water bottle. Something to eat. Candy bars for energy. More chewing gum. Maybe bubble gum, Kelly thought, allowing himself some levity. He checked his watch. 3:20. Things were slowing down out there. Wizard and his number two walked away from their piece of sidewalk, disappearing around a corner. Dagwood soon did the same, getting right into his car while his lieutenant drove. Charlie was gone the next time he looked. That left Archie and Jughead to his south, and Big Bob to the west, both still making sporadic sales, many of them still to upscale clients. Kelly continued to watch for another hour until Arch and Jug were the last to call it quits for the night. And they disappeared rather fast, Kelly thought, not sure how they'd done it. Something else to check. He was stiff when he rose and made another note on that. He shouldn't sit still so much. His dark, accustomed eyes watched the stairs as he descended, as quietly as he could, for there was activity in the house next door. Fortunately, the rats were gone, too. Kelly looked out the back door, and finding the alley empty, walked away from the house, keeping his pace to that of a drunk. 10 minutes later, his car was in sight. 50 yards away, Kelly realized that he'd unthinkingly parked the car close to a streetlight. That was a mistake not to be repeated, he reproached himself, approaching slowly and drunkenly until he was within a car length. Then, first checking up and down the now vacant street, he got in quickly, started the engine, and pulled away. He didn't flip on the headlights until he was 2 blocks away, turning left and re-entering the wide vacant corridor, leaving the not-so-imaginary jungle and heading north towards his apartment. In the renewed comfort and safety of his car, he went over everything he'd seen in the past 9 hours. The dealers were all smokers, igniting their cigarettes with what seemed to be Zippo lighters whose bright flames would injure their night vision. The longer the night got, the less business there was, and the sloppier they seemed to become. They were human. They got tired. Some stayed out longer than others. Everything he'd seen was useful and important. In their operating characteristics, and especially in their differences, were their vulnerabilities. It had been a fine night, Kelly thought, passing the city's baseball stadium and turning left onto Loch Raven Boulevard, relaxing finally. He even considered a sip of the wine, but this wasn't the time to indulge in any bad habits. He removed his wig, wiping away the sweat it had caused. Jesus, he was thirsty. He addressed that need 10 minutes later, having parked his car in the proper place and made his way quietly into the apartment. He looked longingly at the shower, needing the clean feeling after being surrounded by dust and squalor and rats. That final thought made him shudder. Fucking rats, he thought, filling a large glass with ice, then adding tap water. He followed it with several more, using his free hand to strip off his clothing. The air conditioning felt wonderful, and he stood in front of the wall unit, letting the chilled air wash over his body. All this time, and he didn't need to urinate. Had to take water with him from now on. Kelly took a package of lunch meat from the refrigerator and made 2 thick sandwiches, chased down by another pint of ice water. Need a shower bad, he told himself. But he couldn't allow himself one. He'd have to get used to the feeling of a sticky, plastic-like coating all over his body. He'd have to like it, cultivate it, for in that was a part of his personal safety. His grime and odor were part of his disguise. His looks and smell had to make people look away from him to avoid coming too close. He couldn't be a person now. He had to be a street creature, shunned, invisible. The beard was even darker now, he saw in the mirror before heading to the bedroom, and his last decision of the day was to sleep on the floor. He couldn't dirty up new sheets. Chapter 15 Lessons Applied. Hell began promptly at 11 that morning, though Colonel Zacharias had no way of knowing the time. The tropical sun seemed always to be overhead, beating mercilessly down. Even in his windowless cell there was no escaping it, any more than he could escape the insects that seemed to thrive on the heat. He wondered how anything could thrive here, but everything that did seemed to be something that hurt or offended him. And that was as concise a definition of hell as anything he'd learned in the temples of his youth. Zacharias had been trained for possible capture. He'd been through the survival, evasion, resistance, and escape course called SEER School. It was something you had to do if you flew airplanes for a living. And it was purposefully the most hated thing in the military, because it did things to otherwise pampered Air Force and Navy officers that Marine drill instructors would have quailed at, things which were, in any other context, deeds worthy of a general court-martial, followed by a lengthy term at Leavenworth or Portsmouth. The experience for Zacharias, as for most others, had been one he would never willingly repeat. But his current situation was not of his own volition either, was it? And he was repeating SEER School. He'd considered capture in a distant sort of way. It wasn't the sort of thing you could really ignore once you'd heard the awful, despairing electronic raw of the emergency radios, and seen the chutes, and tried to organize a rescap, hoping the jolly green giant helicopter could swoop in from its base in Laos, or maybe a Navy Big Mother, as the squids call the rescue birds, would race in from the sea. Zacharias had seen that work, but more often he'd seen it fail. He'd heard the panicked and tragically unmanly cries of airmen about to be captured. "Get me out of here," one major had screamed before another voice had come on the radio, speaking spiteful words none of them could understand, but which they had understood even so, with bitterness and killing rage. The jolly crews and their Navy counterparts did their best, and though Zacharias was a Mormon and had never touched alcohol in his life, He had bought those chopper crews enough drinks to lay low a squad of Marines, in gratitude and awe at their bravery. For that was how you expressed your admiration within the community of warriors. But, like every other member of that community, he'd never really thought capture would happen to him. Death. That was the chance and the likelihood he'd thought about. Zacharias had been King Weasel. He'd helped invent that branch of his profession. With his intellect and superb flying skills, he'd created the doctrine and validated it in the air. He'd driven his F-105 into the most concentrated anti-air network anyone had yet built, actually seeking out the most dangerous weapons for his special attention, and using his training and intelligence to duel with them, matching tactic for tactic, skill for skill, teasing them, defying them, baiting them in what had become the most exhilarating contest any man had ever experienced. A chess game played in three dimensions over and under Mach 1, with him driving his two-seater Thud and with them manning Russian-built radars and missile launchers. Like Mongoose and Cobra, theirs was a very private vendetta played for keeps every day. And in his pride and his skill, he'd thought he would win, or, at worst, meet his end in the form of a yellow-black cloud that would mark a proper airman's death, immediate, dramatic, and ethereal. He'd never thought himself a particularly brave man. He had his faith. Were he to meet death in the air, then he could look forward to staring God in the face, standing with humility at his low station and pride at the life he had lived. For Robin Zacharias was a righteous man, hardly ever straying from the path of virtue. He was a good friend to his comrades, a conscientious leader mindful of his men's needs, an upright family man with strong, bright, proud children. Most of all, he was an elder in his church who tithed his Air Force salary, as his station in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints required. For all of those reasons, he had never feared death. What lay beyond the grave was something whose reality he viewed with confidence. It was life that was uncertain, and his current life was the most uncertain of all. And faith, even as strong as his, had limits imposed by the body which contained it. That was a fact he either did not fully understand or somehow did not believe. His faith, the colonel told himself, should be enough to sustain him through anything. Was. Should be. Was, he'd learned as a child from his teachers. But those lessons had been taught in comfortable classrooms in sight of the Wasatch Mountains, by teachers in clean white shirts and ties, holding their lesson books, speaking with confidence imparted by the history of their church and its members. It's different here. Zacharias heard the little voice that said so, trying to ignore it, trying his best not to believe it, for believing it was a contradiction with his faith, and that contradiction was the single thing his mind could not allow. Joseph Smith had died for his faith, murdered in Illinois. Others had done the same. The history of Judaism and Christianity was replete with the names of martyrs, heroes to Robin Zacharias, because that was the word used by his professional community, who had sustained torture at Roman or other hands and had died with God's name on their lips. But they didn't suffer as long as you, the voice pointed out. A few hours. The brief hellish minutes burning at the stake. A day or two, perhaps, nailed to the cross. That was one thing. You could see the end of it, and if you knew what lay beyond the end, then you could concentrate on that. But to see beyond the end, you had to know where the end was. Robin Zacharias was alone. There were others here. He'd caught glimpses, but there was no communication. He'd tried the tap code, but no one ever answered. Wherever they were too distant, or the building's arrangements didn't allow it, or perhaps his hearing was off. He could not share thoughts with anyone, and even prayers had limits to a mind as intelligent as his. He was afraid to pray for deliverance, a thought he was unable even to admit, for it would be an internal admission that his faith had somehow been shaken, and that was something he could not allow. But part of him knew that in not praying for deliverance he was admitting something by omission, that if he prayed, and after a time deliverance didn't come, then his faith might start to die, and with that his soul. For Robin Zacharias, that was how despair began, not with a thought, but with the unwillingness to entreat his God for something that might not come. He couldn't know the rest. His dietary deprivation, the isolation so especially painful to a man of his intelligence, and the gnawing fear of pain. For even faith could not take pain away, and all men know fear of that. Like carrying a heavy load, however strong a man might be, his strength was finite and gravity was not. Strength of body was easily understood, but in the pride and righteousness that came from his faith, he had failed to consider that the physical acted upon the psychological, just as surely as gravity, but far more insidiously. He interpreted the crushing mental fatigue as a weakness assignable to something not supposed to break, and he faulted himself for nothing more than being human. Consultation with another elder would have righted everything, but that wasn't possible. And in denying himself the escape hatch of merely admitting his human frailty, Zacharias forced himself further and further into a trap of his own creation, aided and abetted by people who wanted to destroy him, body and soul. It was then that things became worse. The door to his cell opened. Two Vietnamese wearing khaki uniforms looked at him as though he were a stain on the air of their country. Zacharias knew what they were here for. He tried to meet them with courage. They took him, one man on each arm, and a third following behind with a rifle, to a larger room. But even before he passed through the doorway, the muzzle of the rifle stabbed hard into his back, right at the spot that still hurt, fully 9 months after his painful ejection, and he gasped in pain. The Vietnamese didn't even show pleasure at his discomfort. They didn't ask questions. There wasn't even a plan to their abuse that he could recognize, just the physical attacks of five men operating all at once, and Zacharias knew that resistance was death. And while he wished for his captivity to end, to seek death in that way might actually be suicide, and he couldn't do that. It didn't matter. In a brief span of seconds, his ability to do anything at all was taken away, and he merely collapsed on the rough concrete floor, feeling the blows and kicks and pain add up like numbers on a ledger sheet, his muscles paralyzed by agony, unable to move any of his limbs more than an inch or two, wishing it would stop, knowing that it never would. Above it all, he heard the cackling of their voices now, like jackals, devils tormenting him because he was one of the righteous and they'd gotten their hands on him anyway. And it went on, and on, and on. A screaming voice blasted its way past his catatonia. One more desultory half-strength kick connected with his chest, and then he saw their boots draw back. His peripheral vision saw their faces cringe, all looking toward the door at the source of the noise. A final bellow, and they hastily made their way out. The voice changed. It was a white voice? How did he know that? Strong hands lifted him, sitting him up against the wall, and the face came into view. It was Grishinov. "My God," the Russian said, his pale cheeks glowing red with anger. He turned and screamed something else in oddly accented Vietnamese. Instantly a canteen appeared, and he poured the contents over the American's face. Then he screamed something else, and Zacharias heard the door close. "Drink, Robin. Drink this." He held a small metal flask to the American's lips, lifting it. Zacharias took a swallow so quickly that the liquid was in his stomach before he noted the acidic taste of vodka. Shocked, he lifted his hand and tried to push it away. "I can't," the American gasped. "Can't drink. Can't—" "Robin, it is medicine. This is not entertainment. Your religion has no rule against this. Please, my friend, you need this." "It's the best I can do for you," Grishinov added in a voice that shuddered with frustration. "You must, Robin." Maybe it is medicine, Zacharias thought. Some medicines used an alcohol base as a preservative, and the church permitted that, didn't it? He couldn't remember, and in not knowing, he took another swallow. Nor did he know that as the adrenaline that the beating had flooded into his system dissipated,
The natural relaxation of his body could only be accentuated by the drink.
Not too much, Robin.
Grishinov removed the flask, then started tending to his injuries, straightening out his legs, using moistened